Good morning. Our first case this morning is 2019-926, the State of Ohio versus Joseph McAlpern. For the appellant, arguing first will be Mr. Doughton.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am David Doughton, and with John Gibbons, we are representing Mr. McAlpern. We would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal at this time. Your Honor, the issues before the court that are unique to his case are the fact that Mr. McAlpern represented himself pro se in a death penalty case. That's not totally unique, but the issues that have come up because of his representation are. The key issue in this case is whether in fact the Ohio or the United States Constitution even allows somebody for the purposes of a penalty phase to represent himself on a pro se basis. The basis for that it doesn't is in the wording of the Sixth Amendment and Ohio's Article 1, Section 10 itself, where it refers to the accused. The Sixth Amendment indicates that the accused has the right for the assistance of counsel for the purposes of his defense. And of course, the issue becomes once they're convicted, he's no longer the accused and does in fact that protection remain with him. When Feretta was decided,
counsel, is someone convicted if judgment hasn't been entered?
No, not until sentencing in this state. But that's a state statutory finding or unique to this state. But clearly, at the time of Feretta, there was no contemplation. It wasn't based upon when a sentencing entry had been entered. I think what's key in this case is in. The United States Supreme Court kind of sent us a message in the Woodall case, in which on a habeas, the Sixth Circuit had granted habeas because the prosecutor commented on the defendant's right to silence. In Woodall, the Supreme Court indicated that, look, you're making this extension we haven't made. And they specifically say it's not unusual for rights constitutional rules that apply to trial apply somewhat differently in a sentencing phase. And this is exactly that kind of case. As the court is well aware, the basis in Feretta for granting the right to pro se counsel is based on a weighing process. There's no absolute rule that you can represent yourself. There's nowhere in the Constitution does it say a person has the right to represent him or herself. The court got derived this from a variety of rules and found that basically, in a sense, since the Sixth Amendment indicate you have the assistance of counsel, and they derive from a number of rights that you have this autonomy, this personal self-liberty autonomy. That, of course, was weighed against accuracy, the efficiency of the court, the societal interest in due process. In the court in Feretta found that for trial, for the traditional trial, that those interests weighed on the side of the individual. However, for the sentencing phase, the weighing is different. There's already been a conviction. The person's not the accused. Societal interest in accuracy is much greater because all of us, including this Ohio legislature, want accuracy in a capital sense. The issue becomes, the state's interest in the appropriate sentence. If counsel attaches, the defendant does not lose his or her autonomy. In fact, this court had ruled this essentially in a couple of cases that I know personally, Donna Roberts and Curtis Clinton, and under the United States Supreme Court case of McCoy versus Louisiana, the defendant still controls, even though he has counsel, the defendant controls what's put on and what's not put on. In the Roberts case, for instance, she indicated that she only wanted to do an unsworn statement, and in fact, even restricted counsel from making opening statements or statements at all for the penalty phase. And this court, consistent with McCoy, and this preceded McCoy, found that's totally appropriate. You know, she controls. The reason it's so important for counsel to be involved for the penalty phase is under Wiggins v. Smith, the Supreme Court has said counsel has a duty to do a complete and full investigation.
Counsel, did your client ask for an attorney at the mitigation phase?
Did not, Your Honor.
Was that, so when the proceedings began, he did not object in any way?
That is correct.
And he had standby counsel, correct?
That is correct. But the point I'm making is that it's a structural problem. If in fact, this court or the United States Supreme Court would rule in a capital case, societal interests in the Eighth Amendment and due process outweigh the autonomy, it's structural error, because Mr. McAlpin would have been denied counsel altogether. And I want to get back to the Wiggins point. The point being, if counsel under Wiggins is required to do a full investigation, then that information is provided to the defendant. The defendant doesn't have to put it on, but the defendant's choice of how to go forward with mitigation, or if to go forward with mitigation, is fully informed choice, which that client has the right to do. So clearly this becomes a weighing of whether the autonomy is required at or outweighs the interest in having accuracy for the penalty phase. This hasn't been yet decided. The Supreme Court has, the prosecutor indicated in their brief, they cited the Moran case where, you know, the competency evaluation to go forward for penalty phase is no different than others, but that's a different issue. They've never taken on directly, does the weighing that went on in Ferretta, in McAskill, does that outweigh the interest in autonomy or self-liberty interest for the penalty phase? Which leads us to the second issue. You know, McAskill was very clear and consistent with McCoy that once you do provide the interest for a defendant to represent him or herself, the defendant controls. It's just clear the defendant controls totally. In this case, Mr. McAlpin wanted to represent himself. And the cases are clear that as long as he's not disrupting the court, or as long as he is not in any way showing that he can't abide by court rules and will work with standby counsel, that's totally proper. However, the Castle Court, the Supreme Court, made very clear that two things have to happen in order for, you know, this right of self-representation to be respected. First, in front of the jury, it's required that the court go in and standby counsel go to great care to show that, in fact, it is the defendant who's in charge, the defendant who's making the choices, and it's in the defendant's arguments. The second is, and which is what happened here, is what happens off the record. It is the defendant's right to control his defense and what's presented, even if it's ridiculous, even if it has no chance objectively, it's the defendant's right to do so. Counsel, it's standby counsel, is not permitted to do anything to interfere with the defendant's right to control what he presents and how he presents. The unique aspect of this case is that the defendant was not aware of the interference until after the verdict. The state argued in its brief that, you know, this is essentially too late to raise this, but that's not the case. In this case, the defense originally requested a DNA expert. DNA became a very large part of the prosecutor's case to establish that Mr. Malcolm was on the premises where the homicides occurred. During the case, at some point, Mr. McAlpin, on numerous occasions, asked the trial judge, where's my report? What's going on this case? He was never given a good answer. At some point, Mr. McAlpin was able to ask defense counsel, where's the report? And defense counsel indicated, it's not going to help you. You don't want it, it's not going to help you. This is an indication of two things. One, that defense counsel had talked to the DNA expert without consulting Mr. McAlpin. He had not arranged for Mr. McAlpin to be in on the conversation. And two, defense counsel made the decision that it wouldn't help him, which is not defense counsel's to make. It's fine for defense counsel to advise Mr. McAlpin, I don't think he should have the report going, but it's much different that the report wasn't done. Mr. McAlpin then had his family arrange a three-way where he talked to, asked the DNA expert, why didn't you do a report? And a couple things happened. One, she said, I wasn't paid. Well, the court had already approved her to do so. So the fact that she wasn't arranged to be paid necessarily was done by standby counsel, because there's nothing in the record to indicate that Mr. McAlpin had any idea of how to do that. Standby counsel's duty is to facilitate that. Even if standby counsel disagrees with it, it's his duty to facilitate and have the report either made or not made, and the information on the report provided to Mr. McAlpin. Mr. McAlpin reviewed the report of the state investigator, and in doing so, he believed that there were some discrepancy or things that didn't make sense.
Counsel, wasn't this DNA expert engaged before your client stated that he wanted to represent himself?
The company was, Your Honor. There was another person that he thought was representing him, and in fact, somebody else from that company ended up being the one. But yes.
Okay, but that was before he was self-represented, and they agreed to do it, and then apparently the expert refused to speak to him without at least his standby counsel present. Is that true?
Well, that's what the record seems to indicate. Yes, that said, I can't prepare a report, or I can't talk to you without counsel being available.
And what was his response?
Mr. McAlpin's response?
Yes.
I believe that it was he called counsel. He wanted to know what was going on and why he didn't have this information before. And in fact, he filed a mistrial and went to the judge to where all this was brought out on the record. At no point did the actual expert come in and testify. Mr. McAlpin believed that defense counsel had told her not to prepare the report. That was one area defense counsel denied, said that, you know, no, I'd never told her not to do the report. But nothing else was disputed. The problem with this is we have one of these issues that the record isn't totally clear, because neither defense counsel nor the expert was brought in to testify. But it really doesn't matter, because if you're standby counsel and your duty is to facilitate access, Mr. McAlpin is in jail, it's a capital case, he had no way to be able to reach and discuss the decision of whether to have a report done or whether to call that witness or whether to meet with the expert to be able to cross-examine the state expert without having access to that expert. So that a decision by standby counsel, clearly not to have the report made, or, and I'm not sure of the court's point, if the court's point was the appointment was made before he went pro se, I don't think that changes. I don't think there's nothing to indicate that standby counsel, when he was counsel, told the expert not to prepare the report prior to trial. That's nowhere in the record. Even if were the case, that doesn't change anything, because as standby counsel, the defendant has the right to review how to control and prepare his case, and it's imperative and required that standby counsel facilitate that. If counsel purposely didn't report the information or have the report done because it would hurt Mr. McAlpin, that's a structural error problem. Even if defense counsel prior to trial commencing had said, don't prepare a report, that was never told to Mr. McAlpin. And Mr. McAlpin, and only Mr. McAlpin, would have the ability to decide, no, I really do want the report. I do need it. One of the matters in the court is supposedly, according to Mr. McAlpin, standby counsel told him, if the report is prepared, we have to turn it over. That's inaccurate. As the court knows, it doesn't need to be turned over unless it's intended to be used. So that Mr. McAlpin was not given the proper information, even on a belated basis. So that clearly this is one of those indications or cases that Mr. McAlpin was caused to relinquish control, not his stuff, that it was actually defense counsel by omission or commission who prevented him access to an expert. And there was no other way Mr. McAlpin could have that information.
But didn't defense counsel say that wasn't true, that he didn't tell the expert not to talk to?
That part he did. But he did not deny that he said he wouldn't help us. He did not deny that he didn't give the report. He did not deny the conversations that Mr. McAlpin said that he had with defense counsel throughout various stages of trial about that report. In fact, I think the record is the report was never made, and it's not part of the record, and Mr. McAlpin never did see it. So that, and again, harmless error doesn't apply here. You know, this is a case of, if this was a improper interference of Mr. McAlpin's ability to control his case and control what was presented and how it was presented and how his defense was presented, it's structural error. Which brings us to another issue. In this case, and this is a problem with pro se counsel, clearly aware that there's no special rules that when someone goes pro se, the court is not required to step in to protect them. The court can, but is not required to, if inappropriate information is being introduced to the jury. The court's not required to go there. The rules of evidence apply the same. If he doesn't object, it's plain error. And the same harmless standard applies if he does object. But the issue I would like to address the court that's unique to capital cases, in numerous instances, and I won't go through them here, it's in the brief, the prosecutor, it's argued, brought up instances of irrelevant victim impact information, or frankly, just plain irrelevant evidence anyway, in the first phase of trial, which would of course have a carryover effect to the penalty phase. This court has on a couple of occasions recognized that issue. The problem is, he didn't object to many. A couple he did, but most he did not. So we have the prosecutor raised in its brief appropriately the issue of, is this harmless error, is this plain error? Obviously they're arguing it does. But in a capital case, you know, I would ask the court to consider this in relevancy considerations, even for trial. It has a different evaluation than this would be if it were a straight homicide case, because always the information that's provided in the first phase, if inappropriate, there's a danger it's going to be improperly used in the second phase as a non-statutory aggravator. So in other words, in a harmless error analysis, the issue is whether, because Ohio is a single juror case, if the standard generally for harmless error, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the conviction. My argument here is that when you have a case where non-statutory aggravators are being addressed, or matters that are minimally damaging to the defendant and shouldn't be there, example might be, you know, talking about the stepson's, the horrible tragedies had previously, which had no relevance to, you know, who did this particular offense. The issue when you're talking about harmless error, where there's a death penalty takes a single juror. So when analyzing relevance and analyzing harmlessness, the issue is really beyond a reasonable doubt, might this have contributed to a single juror not coming back death? It also in plain air, the issue, the when you're discussing and you have to show that the verdict would have other been otherwise. Well, in a plain air in a death penalty case, it's a little bit of a different standard because it only takes one juror to have found that death is not appropriate. Therefore, it has a, I don't want to say less standard, but it's a different review for a capital case.
So, counsel, what rule are you asking us to write?
I'm asking to write in a capital case when a trial court is addressing trial phase issues, when determining relevance, that the consideration, not only is it relevant to whether defendant did the offense or not, but the danger that a juror may improperly use this in the weighing process in the second phase, that's part of the equation for a ruling on a relevance issue.
And are you saying this because he's pro se or?
No, I'm saying in any case. In this case, there were a number of harmless error issues and a number of waiver issues raised by the prosecutor because Mr. McAlpin either did not object or in the case of the victim impact, he did some objections, but the major was raised post-trial in a new trial motion, which is tardy under Ohio law. He brought it up, but it was late. What I'm asking the court to do in capital cases, when there are objections made, that part of the evaluation that a trial court must make is, okay, maybe this has a teeny relevance and there's not much probative value, but if I allow this in, this jury, you can't unhear it. You can't close the barn door. And if this goes into a second phase, this may cause an inappropriate weighing by the jury. And as such, I'm not going to allow it in. Because you're not ruling on the harmlessness or on the admissibility just for one phase of trial.
Mr. Doten, you don't think that a curative instruction would take care of it?
Actually, no. You know, that it would help. It's the old thing like, you know, how often do you beat your wife? Objection sustained, ignore that. You can't unhear it, particularly.
Mr. Doughton, you've got about 7.5 minutes left and you've reserved 5 for rebuttal. Is Mr. Gibbons going to present?
Just the rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. There are certain things that you can't unhear. One of the things as defense counsel and as reading objectively from paper, when I'm reading about the son and what he went through and what he had previously gone through, I can't unhear that. I can't unhear it. And to be able, and there were other matters in this case that were similar to that. You know, the person that came in supposedly because he didn't want to be a suspect and talked about all of his battles and how these people helped him. Not questioning whether that's true or not, but that had no relevance as to what whether he was somebody who might have been a suspect, which was the state reason for doing that. The problem is those very emotional, deep-seated, not questioning whether it's accurate or not, the jury's weighing that. You can't unhear that. I mean, what would the jury instruction be? Please don't hear those truthful things about wonderful people the victims were in this case. It's a very difficult thing, and it's just better to keep it out in the first place, so you don't have to unhear it. With that, I would ask the court, I'll rest on the brief, unless something comes up in rebuttal, but I would ask this court, one, to find that the waiver of a counsel for the penalty phase is not permitted either under the federal or state constitution, and two, that there was a violation of the Mr. McAlpin's right to self-represent and ask for reversal on that basis.
One more question for you. In the event that we don't agree with you on your propositions of law, is there anything that you want to say about what we're required to do in with 2929.05A and looking at the sentence itself?
Well, this is one of the reasons why the counsel should be appointed, because this court has an independent role, it has always done so, on what the appropriate penalty is. But if this court doesn't have the information, if this court is limited on the information, what do? You know, how can that be a fair way? You're weighing on what the defendant says with no skills and no background. So frankly, it's a, I don't want to say inaccurate, but it's not a complete evaluation of the appropriateness of the penalty in this case. An example of Mr. McAlpin, you know, there's evidence that he suffered sexual abuse when, you know, a sister came in and talked about that, but it wasn't developed. There was no expert to come in. There's no way for this court, one, to know if it's true or not, if it was corroborated, or two, the effect that might have had on him in these offenses. That's the problem with pro se. I mean, the court is limited to the record at this point in time, you know, and the post-conviction doesn't come in at this point for if there's additional matters. I didn't do it, I don't know. But I think that's a problem, and that's the reason there should be counsel for penalty phase.
In that analysis, are we permitted to disbelieve witnesses like a jury would?
I guess yes. I mean, this court does its independent evaluation, and it's not a matter of disbelieving or not believing, but this court would say, I'm affording this little weight, which is, okay, there's something here, but I don't know how severe, I don't know how often, I don't know how much effect that would have on him. So it limits the weight that this court may afford him in its independent analysis.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from the state. Clemmel.
Good morning. Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. My name is Calista Plemmel. I represent the state of Ohio in this matter on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. I'm here today asking this court to affirm Joseph McAlpin's convictions and death sentences in this case. I'd like to begin by stating that this court has repeatedly rejected Mr. McAlpin's first proposition of law. And as recently as State v. Obermiller, a 2016 case, this court has stated that although Feretta was not a capital case, both the United States Supreme Court and this case have applied Feretta in capital cases and have acknowledged that valid waivers of counsel in capital cases will be upheld. This court cites to State v. Dean and also to State v. Jordan. And the next sentence of that case is not, except in the mitigation phase of a capital trial. The next sentence is, it is an abuse of discretion for the trial court to refuse to allow a defendant in a capital case to proceed pro se if the defendant properly invokes the right to self-representation, which is exactly what Mr. McAlpin did here. And if he had not been afforded that opportunity, I can guarantee that Mr. Doughton would be here before this court arguing that the trial court abused its discretion in not allowing him to represent himself. I would also go on to point out to this court that as recently in State v. Hunley, which is an opinion from July of last year, this court affirmed a capital defendant representing himself for the mitigation phase of his trial. He was represented by counsel for the guilt phase, but then invoked his right to represent himself for the mitigation phase, which means that this court has affirmatively held that you have the right to do that. And that makes sense because the mitigation phase is not a sentencing. It is the second part of your bifurcated trial that you are afforded as a capital defendant. All of the same trial rights apply. The jury has to render a verdict. The rules of evidence apply. You must submit evidence. So logically, it makes sense that this is, again, just the second phase of Mr. McAlpin's trial, and his Feretta rights apply exactly the same.
But Ms. Plummel, what about the balancing of interest that Mr. Doughton spoke about, especially in terms of society's interest in the accuracy of the sentence?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I would say first that society's interest in protecting our constitutional rights and ensuring that we are afforded our constitutional rights.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but what I'm getting at is when we're talking about putting someone to death, I think that the public would feel better about it. According to this balancing test, knowing that it was done with accuracy and with integrity in the due process?
Well, one, I would submit to this court that that is what the independent review will do under 292905, but also the Sixth Amendment right to represent yourself and your due process rights of ensuring that you've had a fair trial are not mutually exclusive. But Mr. McGalpin is saying that in order to be afforded this due process that I'm owed as a capital defendant, I absolutely per se am barred from exercising my Sixth Amendment right. But what 45 years of jurisprudence under Ferretta and what this court and every court in the country has held is that as long as you have unequivocally and explicitly invoked your right to represent yourself, you're saying, I want to represent myself, then if the court engages in the appropriate colloquy with you and you knowingly and intelligently waive that right and all of the pitfalls that comes with it, then that is what you are entitled to do, regardless of whether you are actually capable of doing that. You don't have to have the experience as a lawyer or the skills as a lawyer to be able to do that. It's just, did you properly waive your right to counsel? And that is how courts, again, for 45 years have balanced those interests. And I think that is the appropriate way to do it.
But when it comes to a capital case, I mean, there's going to be standby counsel. And I think what I was hearing Mr. Gowton say is that the standby counsel actually sort of caused the defendant to trip up in his own self-representation. So does that nuance make a difference?
Well, and that would speak directly to his second proposition of law, which I'm happy to move on to and answer to you. So first of all, I just would like to set the record straight in that this issue came to the trial court's attention a month after Mr. McAlpin was convicted on his oral motion for a new trial, alleging that he did not receive a DNA report from his expert that he supposedly had requested that his standby counsel provide for him. Now, the record specifically shows that Mr. McAlpin told the trial court again on May 16th of 2019 at page 4593. At the trial, I was told the reason I didn't need my DNA expert report was because it would be harmful, which goes to show that Mr. McAlpin knew exactly why he didn't have a DNA report before trial, and he acquiesced to standby counsel's advice that they not get one because it was likely inculpatory and just confirmed the state's evidence. So counsel, really this is—
Counsel, when they were ramping up for trial, on several occasions, Mr. McAlpin insisted on going forward, insisted on representing to the court that he was fully prepared to proceed to trial.
Yes, and, Your Honor.
Okay, knowing he didn't have his DNA report.
Yes,
yet,
Your Honor.
Yet he did not bring that up to the court or indicate that that was a problem for him in his self-representation in the guilty phase, did he?
He did not ever bring this up to the court. And that's exactly my point is first, this should be analyzed by this court as whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in denying his motion for new trial, because really that's the only avenue here that he was afforded in raising this issue. However, even if we do get to a constitutional, this infringed on my self-representation rights analysis, I would submit to the court that really what he's saying is, this wasn't an affirmative interference of any sort of decision that he was making. This is my standby counsel failed to do something that I wanted them to do, which to me sounds a lot like an ineffective assistance claim, which we know doesn't exist when you represent yourself. And this court in State v. Hackett just recently discussed and says at paragraph 15, without a constitutional right to standby counsel, there is no constitutional entitlement that could ground a claim that standby counsel provide a certain level of assistance. It goes on, when a defendant elects to represent himself, he is foregoing any Sixth Amendment argument based on the idea that counsel, standby or otherwise, provided insufficient aid. And I would say that this is exactly what Mr. McAlpin is claiming, except that he is trying to frame it in a structural error analysis because that's the only way he could possibly win this. Now, even when we get to that analysis, McCaskill v. Wiggins is instructive. And really the test here is, did standby counsel's participation substantially interfere with a significant tactical decision? Now, I would first submit that they did not substantially interfere at all because Mr. McAlpin was going along with their recommendation up and until he was convicted. And he agreed not to get that report until he's sitting and reading through the trial testimony that he created with the state's expert witness saying, wait, this doesn't make sense to me. But even still, it's certainly not a significant tactical decision whether or not to obtain an inculpatory DNA report that you don't intend to admit into evidence or have an expert testify to. And that even if you did want to use it on that cross-examination of the state's witness, the only way you could is to turn it over in discovery. So there's absolutely no interference here. And I would also just like to suggest, because Mr. McAlpin has relied on McCoy versus Louisiana to suggest that this constitutes structural error, that that case is clearly distinguishable because that case involved an attorney admitting his client's guilt over the client's expressed wishes, which I would also agree constitutes structural error, but this rises to not that level, and therefore his argument is completely meritless. I'd also then just like to quickly address Mr. McAlpin's arguments that the standard for the admissibility of victim impact evidence should somehow completely change. And I would submit to this court that you have provided trial courts and parties a breadth of case law and guidance on what is and is not impermissible victim impact testimony, and that determining whether it is not overly emotional or going to the penalty phase is a perfectly acceptable way to define that and for courts to rule on whether or not that evidence should come in. I would also just like to point out that it's the state's position that none of the evidence that Mr. McAlpin now complains of was actually victim impact evidence and went to a facts attendant to Mr. McAlpin's guilt at that guilt phase.
Ms. Plemmel, do you think that a curative jury instruction would take care of any problem with that? You went on mute.
I apologize. I would say a curative jury instruction would take care of that, but also just the standard of review afforded here. And because it is either a plain error standard for most of this testimony or a harmless error, clearly the outcome would not have been different. If the jury did not decide Mr. McAlpin was guilty because the victim's son may have testified that his biological father passed away of a drug overdose when he was 11, or the fact that the victims were high school sweethearts, because again, the evidence in the case was overwhelming. There was DNA evidence, video surveillance evidence, a testifying co-defendant, and other circumstantial evidence. So yes, to answer your question, a jury instruction would cure it, but I don't even think we need to reach that because the standard of review would just say that this had no effect on the outcome of the trial.
Thank you.
And if there are no further questions on those propositions of law, I would just like to ask the court, in conducting its independent review, to find that the evidence supports that the jury and court's findings of aggravating circumstances, that those aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors, and that Mr. McAlpin's death sentence was appropriate and proportionate to cases affirmed by this court in similar cases. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. All right, Mr. McGivens, you have about three and a half, or Mr. Gibbons, I'm sorry, you have 3.5 minutes.
Your Honor, thank you, Your Justices. John B. Gibbons on behalf of Mr. McAlpin. And briefly, Your Honors, I'd like to return again to the issue of what appears to be a substantial record at the penalty phase and in McAlpin's motion for a new trial of perhaps interference with Mr. McAlpin's desires on how he is to present his case. Now, I'm sure Mr. Doughton and I can say myself have acted in the position of standby counsel. And it's not a, a comfortable position, but it's very clear that the role of standby counsel is to carry out the wishes of the client.
Mr. Gibbons, I'm going to ask you the same question about the fact that that I asked Ms. Plummel. Your client insisted on going to trial and assured the court on numerous occasions that he was ready to go to trial and ready to be his own attorney to represent himself pro se, and never mentioned the fact that he's ready in spite of not having a DNA report, or I'd like to have a DNA report, or I don't have one. That was never the subject of his interaction with the court. It was merely the assurance that he's ready, willing, and able to go to trial.
Well, Your Honors, I can merely say that the record will speak for itself, but it apparently, and we all know that trials are very fluid, and decisions about what evidence to introduce, what evidence to gather, that type of thing, often are made during the course of trial. And what the state of Ohio does not focus on is the integrity of the process, and specifically the integrity of the penalty phase of this particular proceeding. And I believe that there is sufficient evidence in the record that shows that it went, his right to self-representation was actually interfered with by his standby counsel. And I'm certain that Mr. McAlpin indicated to the court that he was ready for anything, but I believe that the record is sufficient to cause the court to have some doubts about the integrity of at least the penalty stage of these proceedings, because it appears that there's bickering, debating, and perhaps actual interference with his desires to on how the case should be tried. Other than that, Your Honor, you're fully conversant with the facts and circumstances. I would direct the court's attention specifically to Mr. Doughton's and my request for a remedy, and ask you to carefully consider the remedy. And at the very, very least, I'd ask the court to carefully consider sending this back at least for a new penalty phase. Because of the fact that there is, there has to be some doubt about, in the public's mind and in everyone's mind, the parties, about the integrity of the penalty phase of this proceeding.
Mr. Gibbons, you're saying essentially that the interference occurs when the counsel may be neglectful or exercise judgment that doesn't provide the defendant with all the information he would need to make his tactical decision about how to represent himself. Have I stated that fairly correctly?
Well, Your Honor, you can say it however you choose to, but it, it really appears that there was concealment, debate among standby counsel and the defendant about tactics. And it appears very strongly from the record that standby counsel, in fact, made a decision and actively concealed potential defenses, even if they were nonsensical or wouldn't work in the end. It's Mr. McAlpin's case to try. And I believe that there is sufficient evidence in the record of that, and it impacts the integrity of that particular part of the process at the very, very least.
So you're asking us to create some type of rule where the standard is different as between a lawyer trying the case and the pro se?
No, I'm not. We're not asking for some different rule. We're asking for you to examine the particular facts of this case and determine if there's sufficient facts in the record to merit the case being remanded for at the very least for a new penalty phase.
Thank you. Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement and you will be notified of our decision.
Thanks.